Good afternoon. Hopefully everyone is awake. I know sometimes we go out to eat. This is why I kind of avoid eating after service, especially if I'm going to be preaching, because we're tired. I like to speak probably a long time. I can't guarantee it's going to be short tonight. So if you're tired, please focus. I would encourage maybe taking some notes on some of the material that we are talking about to keep you active. The text of our consideration this afternoon is Deuteronomy 31, verses 1 through 7. Again, if you have a Bible, would you please turn over there, and we're going to examine this text for our study tonight. Deuteronomy 31, verses 1 through 7. The text says, "And Moses went and spake these words unto all Israel. And he said unto him, I am 120 years old this day. I can no more go out and come in. Also the Lord hath said unto me, Thou shalt not go over this Jordan. The Lord thy God, he will go over before thee. He will destroy these nations before thee, and thou shalt possess them. And Joshua, he shall go over before thee, as the Lord hath said. And the Lord shall do unto them as he did to Sihon and to Og and the king of the Amorites, and unto the land of them whom he destroyed. And the Lord shall give them up before your face, that you may do unto them according to all the commandments which I have commanded you. Be strong and of good courage, and fear not, nor be afraid of them, for the Lord thy God, he is that doth go with thee, he will not fail thee, nor forsake thee." Verse 7. "And Moses called unto Joshua, and said unto him in the sight of Israel, Be strong and of good courage, for thou must go with these people unto the land which the Lord hath sworn unto their fathers to give them, that thou shalt cause them to inherit it. And the Lord, he is that doth go before thee, he will be with thee, he will not fail thee, neither forsake thee. Fear not, neither be dismayed." At the Channel View congregation, we have been going through a short series looking at the conquest of the land in the book of Joshua. We've been looking at particularly Joshua chapter 1 on all the different elements that were involved in a successful campaign. If you are familiar with Joshua chapter 1, God talks about that Joshua will have good success. And there are three elements to that good success we see in chapter 1 of Joshua. We see that the leader, Joshua, was to be a man of unique character. He was to be a man who was trained. He was to be a man who knew God's law, and he was to be a man who was a man of faith. We also see in that text the responsibility that the nation of Israel was to have towards this new leader, that they were to be guided by him. They were to trust him and to show obedience to him. And then there is another element, and that was God's involvement with this conquest. Today I want to talk about, in this series that I've been doing in Channel View, I want to talk about the God of this new trailblazer. I want to talk about the God of Joshua. Today in our text, we have backed up historically to a time in which Moses is alive. Of course, in Joshua chapter 1, Moses is dead. God is the one who speaks to Joshua. Here in Deuteronomy 31, it's Moses who summons Joshua, and he gives him this charge over this nation. Now, within this change of authority, Moses personally and verbally tells Joshua that he is to be their leader. We're also told in verse 7 what type of leadership Joshua needs to exhibit over this nation. But verse 8, Moses moves from the command. He moves from the task and the charge and tells Joshua about God's involvement in his leadership and in the conquest of this land. What is stated in these two verses is actually restated in Joshua chapter 1. However, it's much more concise here in this text. Now, it must be noted, when you and I look at the story of Joshua or the book of Joshua, it's a very unique book because there's a lot of success that happens, victory after victory after victory. The people have now been domesticated. They have now been trained in the law and show complete faith to God. But when we read the book of Joshua, because we read so many victories, we sometimes belittle the real challenge that was there. But there is a real challenge for Joshua. He is to be a spiritual leader and a physical leader to this nation. There can be that temptation to kind of dismiss this challenge. We may explain the victories was made because of Israel's massive force. We may say that the reason that they won these wars is because of Israel's grit or because of their strategy that they had employed on the battlefield. We also may say that the reason that they won these wars time and time again is because of the leadership of Joshua. To come to such conclusion regarding Israel's victories as being a result of Israel's leadership or of Israel's manpower is to fail to recognize the historical intervention of the divine. Fail to recognize that element. See, there is a tendency in our world today among some historians who have a secularized and a materialized mental makeup to praise Joshua's ability as a leader and Israel's obedience to that leadership. Some may even dismiss the greatness of these victories that are described in the book, and they will say that either the author had exaggerated the particular challenge that they're facing. What they do, these particular people who have a secularized mindset, is they try to rationalize the narrative to their preconceived notion. Let me give you an example of one or two examples. When you and I read the story of Jericho, some modern commentaries will tell us that at night, secretly, the Israelites went in and eventually opened up the gates. That's why they took the city. In Joshua chapter 10, a very unique story when God halted the sun so that Joshua and his mighty men of valor may pursue his enemies to destroy them. Some will say, well, that wasn't a miracle. That was just a miscalculation of time in the heat of battle. They try to rationalize these things. See, the people that I am speaking of, they approach the Bible with already preconceived notion oftentimes that God doesn't exist. So they take these supernatural events and try to fit it in their interpretation. If they do believe in God exists, they're usually of a deistic viewpoint and would say that God does not get involved with man or a man's history. But my friends, you and I are not of such a camp. As we believe in God, we believe wholeheartedly that He is living, that He is active, that He is involved in man's history and in man's life. See, it was not Joshua's leadership that brought these victories after victories, nor was it the nation of Israel's involvement. Yes, these things were commanded, but when you and I look at the text in the book of Joshua, we see that the reason they won is because God fought for them. I want you to notice a few passages. In Joshua chapter 10, verse 14, "And there was no day like that before it or after the Lord hearkened unto the voice of man, for the Lord fought for Joshua." In verse 42, it says this, "And all these kings in their lands did Joshua take at one time." Why? Because the Lord God of Israel fought for Israel. In chapter 23, verse 3, it says, "And ye have seen all that the Lord your God hath done unto all these nations because of you. For the Lord your God is he that hath fought for you." The conquering of the promised land, as already stated, was too big of a task for Israel. It was a huge task for them to accomplish. But it became a conquered land because of God's aid, because of his blessing. For it was God who gave them the victory. It was God who essentially led them to that victory. See, Joshua, when you and I imagine this historical scene, Joshua is the man that the nation of Israel sees as the leader. But there was a leader to Joshua, and that was God. In the text that we have just looked at in Deuteronomy 31, there's a particular term that is used. We know that Joshua is not only sent out, he's not only given a commission, but the text tells us that he is led into this land, that God is involved in leading him in to this land. Now, you and I, in our Western approach towards the scriptures, we're losing something here. What this is referring to is an ancient practice that was done many years ago. See, in ancient times, when one was making a conquest of a territory, they would often send out scouts or spies ahead of them. These scouts would not only act as spies to the land that they had infiltrated, but also make some preparation for the people that they had served. What they would do, these scouts, they would have a great responsibility. They would go in and observe the people. They would accurately describe the place to their masters and give some suggestion on carrying out the conquest, on where to go and what to avoid. Plus, if it was possible, these scouts were encouraged to solicit help or assistance from the natives who inhabit the land. Now, if the scouts did not fulfill that task, the conquest would start off with much difficulty. It would be a very hard conquest at the beginning. But what made a scout often successful is the character of the man. If the man was careless in observing the details that surrounded him, if he was obnoxious in character and brought attention to himself and destroyed his cover, or if he was rude in recruiting help from the natives, the journey for the conquering nation would suffer. But Joshua and Israel does not have this problem, for it is God who goes before them. Thus, the odds of victory are greatly increased. They're increased to the point that there is no possibility of failure unless on the part of the nation of Israel. However, as the character of the scout was essential in securing success, what is the character of God leading Joshua and the nation of Israel into this land? What is his character? Comparing Deuteronomy 31, verse 7 and 8, and Joshua chapter 1, verses 3 to 6, we see three essential characteristics of God leading the nation of Israel. We see at first that he gives them a vision. Second, we see he promises his presence and his involvement. And third, we will see that he is faithful to them. Now, the very first thing told to Joshua, both by the Lord and both by Moses regarding this holy conquest, is he is given a vision, he is given an aim, he is given a goal of what they, the nation of Israel, will be working towards. In Joshua chapter 1, verses 3 to 4, the text says this: "Every place the sole of your foot shall tread upon that have I given unto you, as I said unto Moses. From the wilderness and this living on, and even unto the great rivers, the river Euphrates, all the land of Hittites, unto the great sea, towards the going down of the sun, shall be your coast." There's the vision that is given to Joshua. There's the vision that is given to the nation of Israel. This is what is set before Joshua. This is the envisioned plan. This is what the end of the conquest will look like if they fulfill it. In this declaration, the vision, Joshua is not merely given a commission to conquer this land, but he's also given a mental picture of what that fulfillment will look like. He is given a mental picture of what it means, or what they are to attain and to have. Essentially, with this vision, Joshua is given a purpose to take this land. Now, when you and I think about the concept of purpose, we often dismiss its overall importance in doing something. Actually, if you and I take the dynamics of doing something, we put more emphasis on the action and not necessarily the motive or the vision or the purpose. But they play a big part in it. See, whenever we don't have a vision, if we don't have a goal to reach, if we don't have something we're going towards, you and I, we stay in a state of limbo. We stay in a state of limbo. What I mean by this is we stay in the state of in between the beginning and the end of the task. It is to be in a constant phase of transition, for we have set out to do something, but because we engage a certain task without a vision or an aim, we'll always be in midway from beginning to end. We can't get to the end because we haven't yet figured out what the end looks like. We don't know what it is. Without purpose, we never come to finality. We never can say we are finished with this task, for again, we don't know what a finished task looks like. Let me illustrate this point. Suppose someone wished to build a home but did not have a vision, a blueprint, or something to look at. Let's suppose he did not have an idea where to put the rooms, the bathrooms, the plumbing, the wiring, etc. Suppose he didn't have a guidance. He started building and just went with the flow. He would not know how much material he'll need. He would not know how long it would take, what work he can do, and what work he will have to contract out, either because he can't do it or because of the laws. Without a proper vision or an aim, a home can be very difficult to build. I'm not saying it's not impossible, but it's going to be very difficult to do it. Let me give you another illustration. Suppose one wished to start a business. They just come out of high school, they come out of college, but they did not have a vision of what that business is. He did not know what type of business. He didn't know whether he was going to sell something or provide services. He didn't know how many employees he'll need, how much the cost will be, etc., so on and so forth. Again, without purpose in this particular arena, as we see all the time, the business would fail. Let me give you a historical example. On June 6, 1944, when the Allied forces land on Normandy beaches without the purpose and a vision to take that beach, they would have failed. That was their goal, and they were going to get it done. Because of that vision, they were able to estimate the amount of men that was needed. They were able to determine the strategy that would work, and they were able to build up the confidence and the morale of these men that they were fighting for something greater than themselves. For without this conquering of the beach, they would have failed to work inland to defeat Nazi Germany. We can jump from one illustration to another, but God tells us this: where there is no vision, the people perish. They suffer. I think the reason they suffer is they stay in that state of limbo, never get anything done. See, my friends, a vision, an aim, or a purpose empowers. It motivates. It gives reason to accomplish the task. As Joshua was called to lead this conquest, God does not turn Joshua loose to find some honorable cause to which he can give his life to. Joshua, as many of God's leaders, are given a specific task, and Joshua is given a vision of what that task will look like when it is finally fulfilled. But the purpose given to Joshua, there's a key element here. The purpose that is given to Joshua is not one that originated out of the heart and the imagination of man. This is a plan that God has given him. Thus, this is a divine purpose provided for Joshua, and because of this inherent nature that it had originated from the heavens, it is a plan that will come to pass. Nothing will stop it. The Bible tells us that God's plans cannot be overthrown. And in Job chapter 42, verse 2, we're told that. He says, I know that thou canst do it, canst do everything, and I know things, and that no thought can be withhold from thee. The ESV and says, no purpose of yours can be thwarted. We're also told in Psalms 33, verse 11, that the counsel of the Lord standeth forever. It standeth forever. And in Isaiah 46, verse 10, we're told that it will come to pass. It will be accomplished, the plan of God. Because this aspect of God's plan, thus those who are acting them out can do so with great confidence. Why? Because they're engaged in something that will come to pass. It will happen if we're engaged in the plans of God. See, just knowing and being aware of this truth, that God's plan will be accomplished and that we have merely been enlisted to aid in that task, confidence, boldness, and assurance comes out and it rests us. We stand on a strong foundation knowing that the task will come to pass if it had originated from the heavens. In the Speaker's Bible, on a note for Joshua chapter 1, verse 6, talking about the empowerment of purpose, it says this: when a man knows that he had been called to do a certain task, he is invincible. He's not unconscious of his own deficiencies, whether they be natural or intellectual. He is not insensible of difficulty, not so quick as to see the great stone, the iron gates, the walled cities, the broad and flowing rivers. He is not invulnerable to the shaft of ridicule and adverse criticism, but from all these he looks steadily away to the declared purpose of God and yields himself to be the channel through which it may operate. The supreme inquiry for each of us when summoned to a new work is not whether we possess sufficient strength or qualification for it, but if we have been called to it of God. And when that is so, there is no further cause for anxiety. It is in his plan that we should march through a river to attack a walled town or turn to fight an army. We have simply go forward. He will make the mountains away. Rivers will dry up. Walls will fall down. Armies will be scattered. There is no such thing as an impossibility when God says, forward, arise, go over this Jordan. Nothing will stop the plan of God to come to pass. Now, with this note, consider we should see the tremendous value of purpose, especially if that purpose is divine purpose. Just as we see here and many other places that when God calls one to a great task, he often begins with a great vision, one that may intimidate us and cause us to think it cannot be done or that it will not happen, but it will. Now, as members of the body of Christ, we have received a vision. The vision is stated in Matthew 28, and the vision is stated in Mark 16. Now, you are familiar with these passages, but I want you to notice the questions that are answered regarding our vision. Where shall we go? The text tells us, to all nations, to all people, created in the image of God. So that's covered. Where shall we go? To the people. What shall we do? What are we going to be doing when we go to these people? The Bible tells us that we're to teach the gospel and make disciples. That's part of the vision. And how is this done? The text tells us by them believing and being baptized. There's the vision you and I have given to the church. We don't have to be in a state of limbo or figuring out what we need to do. We know what we need to do. And with this, consider, you and I, we learn that the church is not a political machine. We learn that the church is not a social machine. We learn that the church is not an entertaining machine. We learn that the church is not a social service or a welfare machine. We are to be a gospel-preaching, disciple-making, evangelistic-focused organization. This is the intent of the design, to bring all people to the throne of Christ to teach them how to bow their knee before their Lord. Now, as Joshua and Israel were motivated by their purpose, let us too share the same zeal and devotion on our God-given and ordained vision. The second thing we observe in our text that God promised and provided to Joshua in the conquest is his abiding presence. We are told this in Joshua chapter 1, verse 5. There shall not any man be able to stand before thee all the days of thy life. As I was with Moses, this is God speaking, so I will be with thee. I will not fail thee nor forsake thee. Now, what does this entail? What does it mean to have God's divine presence? This is not to be confused with the presence of being like that found in time and space, like the presence of all of us here in this building. What this means is to be in God's grace. It means to be in God's protection. It means to be within his blessings. This is actually an expression of speech often used in the Old Testament scriptures that God is telling the person that he will be involved in their life. He will be involved in the mission that he has given Joshua. Thus, when Joshua is told that God's presence will continue to be there like it was with Moses, Joshua is to take this as Moses was blessed with gifts, as he was guided, as he was protected, the same thing will be given to Joshua. That's how Joshua is to read this. This is how Joshua is to interpret what God is telling him in this text. See, we know that in this chapter of Joshua chapter 1, a transition of leadership is made. The once beloved leader of Israel, Moses, he's gone. His counsel, his wisdom, his ability, his character is also no longer present, no longer available to consult. That space in which Moses had occupied for 40 years is now empty in Joshua chapter 1. The text tells us in Joshua chapter 1 that Moses is dead. It starts off with that. Moses is dead. And that's a reality that must settle in the mind of the Israelites and must set in the mind of Joshua. But I want you to notice that the scripture speaking of Moses is dead, it does not say the work is dead. It doesn't tell us in that text. It doesn't tell us because Moses is gone, God is gone. We have an assurance here that was given to Joshua. Joshua is to know that because Moses is gone doesn't mean God has left them. See, there is a tendency with men to look to the great men of the past and to associate God's presence or blessings with the life of a single individual. We have a tendency to do that. Just think about this for a moment. When we study and review church history or biblical history, our landmarks, our mental bookmarks of events, of happenings, and movements of God are often associated with a person. I'll give you an example. When we think about the church growing in the first century, we think of Apostle Paul. There are other apostles involved there, but we often think of Apostle Paul. In the second and third century, when the pagans would start challenging the Christian doctrine, saying it was superstition, and those who came and defended the faith, the apologists, we think of Justin Martyr. We don't think of other guys. When we think about the Reformation, our mind thinks of Martin Luther. We don't think of the other guys that were involved with the Reformation. The Second Great Awakening, or the First Great Awakening, however you want to count it, we think of Jonathan Edwards as being the man who is behind that movement. The Restoration Movement, we think of Alexander Campbell. We forget about his father, Barton W. Stone, and Raccoon John Smith, and so on and so forth. We are persuaded that the reason that there was such a great movement in time past is because of some great individual. That's what we're persuaded on. And we would accredit the success of the individuals because he summoned the presence of God. I heard a man describe this view once, that God's working and his presence is like the wave of the ocean. The tide comes in and then it goes out. So is the blessings and the happening of God, or God's involvement with his people. It goes in and goes out, and this is the pattern of eternity, is what this man had told me. But this is not true. This is not true that when one passes, the work sets like the sun. Not true that when God works with his people, that he's like the tide of the ocean that comes in and comes out. E. Morgan, in his work called The Cause of God, says God buries the worker, but he carries on the work. That is true. See, my friends, God's presence is not linked to a specific man, but it's linked and it's connected to his work that is being done. The man is simply the instrument that God uses to accomplish his design. Moses was an instrument of God to bring forth his divine plans, but now Joshua will carry the torch, and he can do so with confidence, knowing that God is with him. Not because Joshua is special, but because Joshua is in the work of God. That's why God will be involved. Now, as Joshua takes on this task, as he leads Israel into the hostile and foreign land, as he declares war on those who reside within his land, fear may come, anxiety may intensify, and loneliness may creep in, but Joshua's confidence and his courage is to elevate upward when his memory brings forth those words, "As I was with Moses, so shall I be with you." Now, in our day and age, in the church, the dynamics of God's work has changed. We have no holy conquest like we read in Joshua chapter 1 or in the entirety of Joshua. However, we still have a divine commission, as we saw there in Mark 16 and Matthew 28. Thus, the work is not associated with any special man, but that we are all active participants in this endeavor. Matter of fact, on this idea that it's not my work or that it's not anyone else's work, that we are merely instrument, this idea should be constantly brought forth when you and I identify ourselves as members of the Church of Christ. That should be something that comes to our mind all the time, that it's not our work, that it's not our church, but it's Christ's church. This is probably one of the reasons why we may be so dogmatic in preserving this proper and biblical name. See, unlike the denominational world that names itself after specific persons or specific movements, we identify ourselves by our founder. And in this self-identification, we acknowledge willingly every time that it's his work, that it's his church, it's his people, it's his cause, and we are just so happy to be part of it. And because of this, because it's God's and because it's Christ's work and that you and I are engaged in the work, we are also, as members of the church, promised the involvement of God. Notice what the Bible says in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 4-9. It says, "For while one saith, I am of Paul, and another, I am of Apollos, are you not carnal? Who then is Paul and who is Apollos, but ministers by whom you believe, you know, as the Lord gave to every man? I have planted Apollos water, but God gave the increase. So then neither is he that planteth anything, neither he that watereth, but God that giveth the increase. Now he that planteth and he that watereth are one. And every man shall receive his own reward according to his own labor. For we are laborers or co-workers together with God. You are God's husbandry. You are God's building. My friends, there are some tasks that are purely impossible to accomplish when God is left out. This is true when we go and set out to build a church. You and I, we can build a religious and a social organization. There are thousands of those already in the state. But to build the church of Christ, to build the church of God, the institution prophesied in the Old Testament scriptures, and that has been established in God's eternal will, to build that, God is a necessary element, and he's a necessary requirement. He must be present. And here in this passage, we are told that he will be involved. He will be present. In verse 9 of this text, we are told that we as members of the church, we are fellow workers, we are companions in the work with God. Like Paul and Apollos, we have a part in watering and planting. We have a part to fulfill the vision that's established there in Mark 16 and Matthew 28. But it's still the working of God that gives the increase. See, Paul, Apollos, Peter, and many great saints of the past contribute many things to the work, but they all acknowledge that it was not their own doing. They acknowledge that they were not sufficient for the work, nor did they view themselves as a key figure to the work. He who got all the glory, according to this text, he who got all the praise is the one who gave the increase, and that was God. It is his vineyard, it is his building, it is his church, it is his work. Again, we're just happy to be part of it. So then, like Joshua, we have another thing given to us by God and his work, and that is his abiding and continued involvement in our work, or in his work. The final promise God provides to Joshua in this conquest is God will be faithful. In Joshua chapter 1, verse 6, a promise is brought to the mind of Joshua. He says, "Be strong and of good courage, for unto these people shalt thou divide for inheritance the land which I swore unto their fathers to give them." Now, what is spoken of here in this latter part about the land that I swore unto their fathers to give them, we see the very first time this promise is mentioned to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 to 2, where he was called out of Ur, and he would be given a land unto a land that I will show thee. This particular promise here is reinstated to Abraham's son Isaac and reinstated to his grandson Jacob. And in time, eventually, at the close of Genesis, after the family of Israel had left that land and came into Egypt, Joseph reminds his family about this promise. In Genesis chapter 50, verse 24, "And Joseph said unto his brethren, I die, and God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land unto the land which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." After 400 plus years of the children of Israel in Egypt had multiplied, but now under a racial oppression by the Egyptian government, we see Moses is chosen to be the leader. But God also reminds him of this promise. In Exodus chapter 6, verse 8, "I will bring you unto the land concerning that which I did swore to give to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, and I will give it to you for an heritage. I am the Lord." Now, in our text today of Joshua chapter 1, the nation of Israel is about to fulfill this promise. They're about to take this land, something that has been mentioned time and time again, but now they're there, they're going to get it, they're going to take over it. This promise will be actualized, it will become a reality to Israel. Matter of fact, God's faithfulness that is expressed in these texts is actually a unique aspect of God's identity. In Exodus chapter 3, verse 13 to 15, when Moses was having a conversation with God, I want you to notice that God's being a faithful God is part of who God is. Now, if you have never considered this text, I would encourage you to study this text when you get home, because we learn who God is in this text. We learn the name of God. It's very powerful. And Moses said unto God, "Behold, when I come unto the children of Israel, shall say unto them, the God of your fathers has sent me unto you, and they shall say to me, what is his name? What shall I say unto them?" And God said unto Moses, "I am that I am." Jesus and John uses that term. Very powerful. And he said, "Thus shall thou say unto the children of Israel, I am has sent me unto you." And God said moreover unto Moses, "Thou shalt say unto the children of Israel, the Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me unto you. This is my name forever. And this is my memorial unto all generation. This part of God's name was to bring the Israelites' mind into recognizing that the God they serve was not only a God who gave a promise, but he is a God who fulfills his promise. He will move heaven and earth to make it happen. So when Joshua is handed the torch of leadership, this is another thing that is given to him by God. God does not only promise a vision to work towards or provides a sense of assurance or comfort that he will be involved in this work, but God tells Joshua, the things that I tell you, they will come to pass. He promises his faithfulness to those plans. He is actively engaged to bring about his plan in man's world and in man's history. Now, we had saw this in our opening within our study that God fought for Israel, that God had promised this land to the Israelites. He had promised them victory and promised them blessing. And nothing in the celestial world was going to delay or halt that plan coming to fruition. God was faithful, he was devoted, and he is true to its fulfillment. Now, I am sure throughout the conquest of this land by Joshua, who was assigned this enormous task, may have been darkened by uncertainty. He may have been one who caught up in worries and doubt of this cause. The reason I assume that is Joshua, like all of us, when given a task of enormous caliber or responsibility, can be overwhelmed emotionally and mentally. There may have been a time where Joshua lost sight of the vision and no longer was emboldened by the presence of God or God's involvement. There may have been a time like the defeat of Ai that Joshua doubted that they could conquer the entirety of the land. That was just their second battle and they lost. I know these are mere speculations in the mind of Joshua, but such was true. If it was true, in order for Joshua to be re-energized to the task, he simply needed to be reminded of God's faithfulness. Then he can get it done. Like Joshua, as we have already seen, we as a church have been granted a vision, an aim to work towards. We are not alone in this effort, but our co-worker is with God. He is involved with us. And we have that promise that he will give the increase, as we saw in 1 Corinthians 3. If our being is devoted to this cause as it ought to be, and when the mission does not go as planned or meet our expectation, often darkness, discouragement, and a sense of defeat can burden our soul. It feels as though a weight has been tied to us and that we are cast into the deep of the ocean and that there is no hope of surfacing. Satan can plant uncertain thoughts in our mind that are counterproductive to the work. He can force us to ask the question, are we pleasing God? Should we secularize and culturalize our teaching and practice? We have done our part to the best of our ability, but yet no result. Have we lost the blessing of God? Have God removed his candlestick from us? We can add line after line to what thoughts befall upon a discouraged soul, but there can be a revival to our mind and to our hearts. And that revival is ablaze when we remind ourselves of God's faithfulness. That he will give the increase. As long as we are planting and watering, God will grow the church. He will. He tells us so. Maybe not to our expectation, wishes, or time. But God is faithful to his promise. It will come to pass. As we come to the close, we see that a successful outcome of this conquest was not only placed upon Joshua, his responsibility as being a true leader, but God played a key role in this conquest. He is the one who gives them the vision to strive to. He is the one who provides assurance of his continued presence, and he reminds them of his faithfulness to his plans, his internal plans. Also, as we have seen, that what God tells Joshua, what he will do for him and for the conquest, we have seen that there are parallels to what he does for the church. God has given us a vision to evangelize to all nations. That's our vision. God's presence, he is involved in the sense that he will give the increase when we go and work. And God promises to be faithful to that promise. You and I know if you're engaged in this work that the task is not an easy one. There are many challenges, but we don't take this on alone. We must have faith in God as He aids us in His mission.